You know, you can have the most beautiful website in the world, like stunning graphics, incredible copy.
A user interface that just feels like magic.
Right, exactly. But if the engine underneath it all, the code, the structure, the actual architecture is a total mess, nobody is ever going to find it.
They won't even know it exists?
Yeah. Okay, let's unpack this because treating a website like it's just some digital brochure is a massive vulnerability. Today, we are stepping into the garage, we're putting on the overalls, and we're going to act like mechanics for your website's technical foundation.
It's really the only way to look at it if you want to survive in modern search. I mean, we live in an era of absolute information overload, and technical SEO, at its core, is just about removing friction.
Removing friction between your site and the search engine.
Right, precisely. It's about eliminating that friction for the algorithms trying to evaluate you. If the algorithm has to, struggle to understand your site, it simply won't bother. It'll just move on to your competitor.
Yeah. Wow. And the goal for this comprehensive deep dive today is to completely shortcut your learning curve on how to remove that friction. We are going to look under the hood using two powerhouse diagnostic tools: Screaming Frog SEO Spider and Google Search Console.
The absolute gold standard tools.
Yeah, we're getting past the surface level metrics here. We want to show you how to properly configure a real audit, diagnose the critical errors that are actually tanking your visibility, and maybe most importantly, build a prioritized fix list that your development team will actually respect.
That last part is so crucial because if you don't know how to translate complex technical findings into an action plan, you aren't doing SEO.
Right, you're just complaining.
Exactly. You're just handing a developer a massive, intimidating spreadsheet of complaints. And I promise you, they will ignore you. But, to build that plan, you first need the right data.
So you have to plug the diagnostic tools in correctly.
You do. And Screaming Frog is effectively the industry standard for this.
Yeah, and for those who want to experiment, there is a free version that handles up to 500 URLs. But for enterprise-level sites, or if you want unlimited capacity and advanced API integrations, you're going to need the paid license.
Right, which runs about $279 a year.
Yeah. But just buying the tool doesn't magically fix anything. You can't just, drop in your homepage URL, click start, and expect the data to be perfect.
Far from it. I mean, if you don't configure the crawler properly before you start, every single piece of data you analyze downstream is compromised.
Oh, wow. So where do we start with the setup?
It begins with your crawl mode. Are you running a spider mode crawl where the bot acts like a traditional search engine, starting at a single URL and recursively following every internal link it finds?
Or are you using list mode?
Right, where you manually feed it a very specific list of URLs to audit.
Which, I mean, list mode makes perfect sense if you're pulling a specific batch of high priority pages from analytics and only want to audit those.
Yeah, exactly.
But the second setting, the render mode, this seems to be the one that completely makes or breaks the entire diagnostic
Oh,
process.
absolutely.
Because the default setting out of the box is text only, meaning the crawler just reads the raw HTML. But if you're auditing a modern site built on a JavaScript framework like React, Angular, or Vue, isn't running a text-only crawl basically like sending a building inspector in with a blindfold on?
Yes. What's fascinating here is just how completely blind that robot really is. Decades ago, servers processed everything. They sent a perfectly finished HTML document directly to your browser.
Right, the whole page was already built.
Exactly. But today, with JavaScript frameworks, the server often just sends an empty shell. The browser itself has to execute the JavaScript to actually assemble the content.
So the navigation links, the canonical tags, the product grids.
None of it is there initially. And a text-only crawl doesn't run JavaScript, so it just looks at that empty shell and assumes the page is blank.
Oh man. So you might look at your resulting audit and think, wow, I have zero broken links. My site is flawless.
But it's a massive false positive. You didn't find any broken links because the crawler couldn't see any links at all.
So to take the blindfold off, you absolutely have to switch the render mode to JavaScript. And when you do that, the crawler starts using what's called a headless Chromium browser.
Yes, which is highly resource intensive.
Right. And if I understand the underlying mechanism correctly, that's essentially a fully functioning web browser, just like Chrome, but it runs entirely silently in the background without any graphical interface.
Exactly. It's a ghost browser. It does all the heavy lifting of executing those client-side scripts and assembling the final fully loaded state of the page.
But without rendering the visual pixels to a screen.
Right. which is why it's not the default setting, because it takes computing power.
Right.
But it is the absolute only way to see the website the same way modern search engines do.
Okay, so the render mode is locked in, the blindfold is off. The next configuration step is setting your user agent. And there is a critical nuance here, right? Because there are actually two independent user agent settings you have to configure.
Yeah, they serve distinctly different functions in the network request. First, you have the HTTP request user agent. This is what your crawler tells the web server it is when it first knocks on the digital door.
Because the server might have security protocols that block unknown bots.
Or it might serve different content to mobile devices versus desktops. Then you have the robot's user agent. This is the setting that dictates which rules inside the site's robots.txt file the crawler is going to actually obey.
So if your goal is to audit how Google is experiencing your site, you need to set both of these to Googlebot.
Precisely. You want your crawler to hit the same server-side security rules, the same mobile formatting, and the exact same access delays that Googlebot deals with. You have to emulate the exact entity you are optimizing for.
Makes perfect sense. Now, the final setup step is custom extraction. I love this feature.
It's incredibly powerful.
Because instead of just relying on the default metrics the tool pulls, you can instruct it to grab specific pieces of data unique to your business. You can set up to 100 extractors, I think, maxing out at 1,000 total.
Right.
You use things like Rajax or XPath or CSS paths. But let's pause there, because those sound like incredibly dense programming concepts. If I'm a marketer trying to pull data, how do these actually work in practice?
It's actually highly intuitive once you grasp the concept. Mm. Let's take XPath. Think of an HTML document like a massive, complex filing cabinet.
Okay.
XPath is essentially handing the crawler a very precise treasure map. You're telling it, go into the third drawer, find the second folder, and read the fifth line of text.
Oh, I see. So for an e-commerce site, you could use an XPath to tell the crawler to look specifically at the div container holding the product price.
Exactly. And scrape that exact number for every single URL.
That's amazing. And Rajax regular expressions, that's more about finding specific patterns of text, right? Like telling the crawler, anytime you see a string of numbers formatted exactly like our internal SKU system, grab it.
Exactly. It's pattern matching. But the real power move here is extracting JSON-LD.
The structured data.
Yes. JSON-LD is the behind-the-scenes code that tells a search engine explicitly, this page is a recipe, or this page is a product that is currently in stock.
Right.
By setting up a custom extraction for JSON-LD, you can verify at scale that your development team didn't accidentally wipe out all your structured data during the last site update.
Which happens all the time.
All the time.
Okay, so our setup is bulletproof. We hit start, the headless browser does its thing, and suddenly we were staring at tens of thousands of rows of data. How do we parse the vital signs here? Let's talk about server responses first, specifically redirects. Because the difference between a redirect chain and a redirect loop seems to be the difference between a mild annoyance and a catastrophic failure.
It absolutely is. Let's look at the mechanisms. A redirect chain is sequential. Page A is moved, so it redirects to page B.
Okay.
But wait, page B was moved last year, so it redirects to page C. Ultimately, page C returns a 200 success code. The browser and the algorithm do eventually get to the final destination.
But the toll it takes to get there is massive, right? Screaming frog flags chains as a medium severity warning.
Massive. Every single hop in that chain forces the crawler to make another request to the server. It burns through your crawl budget.
Meaning Google wastes time following chains instead of discovering your new content.
Exactly. And it dilutes the authority being passed between the pages.
Yeah.
It's bad for efficiency, but you know, the page does get indexed.
A redirect loop, however, breaks the machine entirely. It's a high severity error.
A loop traps the bot.
Huh.
This happens when the sequence cycles back to a URL it has already visited.
Oh, no.
Yeah. Page A redirects to page B, but someone accidentally configured page B to redirect right back to page A.
It
creates an infinite cycle. The server gets stuck in a feedback loop. The crawler realizes it's trapped, hits a maximum redirect limit, and it just gives up. Googlebot will drop the page entirely. It cannot index a page. It cannot resolve.
And resolving a loop requires a very specific sequence of actions. You can't just delete a line of code.
No, you have to be methodical. First, you have to go into the server configuration or the CMS and actually break the circular reference, stop the infinite loop.
Right.
Then you have to comb through your site, find all the internal links pointing to that broken original URL, and update them. Finally, you implement a single hop 301 redirect to the correct final destination.
It requires surgical precision, which is why you fix loops before you even look at a single chain.
Always. You prioritize issues that actively block indexation.
Makes sense. Now, quickly on duplicates, you're checking page titles, which should be 30 to 60 characters, and meta descriptions, which are 70 to 155 characters, just looking for identical strings, right?
Easy fixes.
But I want to pivot to the content side of the audit, specifically the thin content warnings. When you run this crawl, the tool defaults to flagging any page with fewer than 200 words as a low content page.
Yes, it does.
Which aligns with a lot of older industry guidelines like Yoast SEO recommending a 300-word floor for editorial content. But I really have to push back on this.
Okay, let's hear it.
If I have an e-commerce site where the product page is just a high-resolution gallery, a price, and a buy now button,
right,
or just a standard contact us page, if I blindly export this report and tell my engineering boss we have 5,000 thin content errors, aren't I just creating a false crisis?
You're touching on a massive pitfall. If we connect this to the bigger picture, this is exactly where human analysis has to override automated tooling.
Context is everything.
Exactly. Word counts are a heuristic, not a law. You have to categorize the intent of the page.
Yeah.
If you have an editorial page, like a travel guide or a blog post, and it only has 140 words, yes, that is a problem.
Because it provides zero unique value.
Right. It needs to be either expanded or consolidated into a larger hub page.
But structural pages don't need a thesis attached to them.
Not at all. A login portal, a booking confirmation screen, a contact form. These pages serve a functional intent, not an informational one. They are perfectly fine having 30 words on them.
So you have to filter the data.
If you don't filter your data based on page intent, you lose all credibility with your developers because you are raising alarms over architecture that is functioning flawlessly.
Which brings up a related and, frankly, much sneakier issue, the soft 404.
Oh, these are the worst.
Let's break down the mechanism of why this happens because it's fascinating. A normal 404 is a server explicitly saying, this page does not exist.
Like a clean dead end.
A soft 404 is when the server returns a 200 success code, saying everything is perfectly fine, but the human looking at the screen sees a page not found or out of stock message.
It is a profound disconnect between the server infrastructure and the database. Typically, this happens because the content management system successfully loads the global website template.
Like the header, the navigation menu, the footer.
Exactly. Because those global elements load successfully, the server happily sends a 200 success code. But the database query for the actual body of the page comes back empty.
Oh, man. So you see this all the time on travel sites when a specific flight route is sold out, or e-commerce sites when a product variant no longer exists.
Right. And Google absolutely hates this because the machine reads the 200 code and thinks the page is valid, so it indexes it.
But then a user clicks on it in the search results and they hit a dead end.
It destroys the user experience and severely degrades your site's quality signals.
Right.
You have to configure your database to force a true 404 or 410 status code when the main content query is empty.
Okay, so we've run the crawl, we've mapped out the redirect loops, we've contextualized the thin content, we understand the soft 404s, we have our internal blueprint, but now we need to see how the city inspector views the house.
Yes.
We have to cross-reference our Screaming Frog data with Google Search Console.
Because Screaming Frog tells you what you built. Google Search Console tells you if the algorithm actually values it. And the integration here is brilliant.
You connect the URL inspection API directly into your Screaming Frog crawl.
It'll pull Google's exact indexation status for every URL right into your spreadsheet.
Though it is capped at 2,000 URLs per day per property.
Right.
So if you have an enterprise site, you have to use that list mode we talked about earlier to audit in strategic batches. But once we have that data, we are looking at the story of how our URLs interact with Google. Let's trace that journey.
The first major status you'll encounter is crawled, currently not indexed.
This is a high priority one. So Google found the page, the bot actually crawled it, but they decided not to put it in their database. It's basically like a bouncer at a high-end club looking at your ID, looking at your outfit, judging you, and deciding not to unclip the velvet rope.
That is a perfect analogy. And this raises an important question because the most common reaction from marketers when they see this status is to just go to GSC and repeatedly click the request indexing button.
Right. They just keep handing the bouncer the same ID over and over again.
Hoping he suddenly changes his mind.
But he won't. You can't just keep handing him the ID. You have to change the outfit.
Exactly. If Google crawled it and didn't index it, that is a quality gate failure. The algorithm has explicitly judged the content as too low value, too thin, or too heavily duplicated to deserve space in their server farms.
Indexation is not a right. It is earned.
You have to dramatically improve the content or consolidate it. Hitting request indexing does nothing.
What about the next status? Discovered currently not indexed. How is that different?
Think of this as the club simply being too crowded. Discovered means Google is aware the URL exists. Maybe they saw it in an XML sitemap or found a link to it, but they haven't even bothered to crawl it yet.
Ah, so it's a medium priority issue.
Right. It is rarely a quality issue. It is a crawl budget issue. Google's algorithms decided that crawling your site right then would overload your server, so they postponed it.
So if it's just a postponement, do you ignore it?
If it's a handful of pages, yes, it will likely resolve itself. But if you see this status across thousands of pages on a large site, it's a massive red flag about your site architecture.
It means your site is too deep, your internal linking is poor, and the crawler is running out of budget before it can reach your deeper pages.
Exactly.
Now, let's look at a status that deals with identity theft. Duplicate. Google chose different canonical. This one is flagged as a high priority error, and I want to push back on this one.
Go ahead.
If we put a canonical tag on page A, explicitly telling Google, hey, this is the master version, index this one, why does Googlebot just decide to ignore our tag and choose page B instead? Shouldn't the bot just follow the instructions it's given?
That's a fundamental misunderstanding of how search algorithms work today. Canonical tags are hints, not directives. Google treats your code as a suggestion.
The suggestion.
Yeah. If the algorithm looks at page A, looks at page B, and realizes the content is 95% identical, but page B has more external backlinks and better user engagement, Google is going to assume the developer made a mistake. It will override your canonical tag to serve the page that users actually seem to prefer.
So they are actively auditing your technical implementation against user experience signals, and if they conflict, user experience wins.
Every single time. If you see this status, you have to figure out why Google is overriding you. Usually means your pages are just far too similar and need to be merged.
Which brings us to the final status on the journey. Alternate page with proper canonical tag.
This is a success state. This means you have a duplicate page, you properly pointed the canonical tag to the master version, and Google looked at the setup and said, "We agree."
Expected behavior.
Right. No action required. Do not waste a single second trying to fix this.
Which perfectly transitions us to the final phase of this process. We've gathered the data, we've overlaid Google's perspective, we know what's broken, now we have to fix it.
The hardest part.
Yeah. And if you look at the ERA 2026 State of Technical SEO report, a staggering 67% of in-house teams cite developer bandwidth as their primary barrier to success. We touched on this earlier. You cannot just throw a raw, unorganized spreadsheet over the fence.
Because SEO teams and development teams speak entirely different languages.
Mm-hmm.
And they are incentivized by totally different metrics.
Yeah.
Developers have product roadmaps. They have technical debt to manage. They have their own sprint cycles.
Right.
If you hand them 500 rows of errors without context, you're just creating noise.
Right.
You have to approach this with a prioritization matrix based on two vectors, traffic impact and implementation effort.
Okay. So you score the impact using GSC search analytics. Mm-hmm. If a broken page gets more than 500 impressions a month, that's high impact. 50 to 500 is medium, less than 50 is low.
Exactly.
So what does this all mean? Let me pose a scenario here. What happens when the technical severity conflicts with the business impact?
Well, this happens constantly.
Like, if I find a massive, high-severity redirect loop that's trapping the crawler, but it's on a legacy blog post from 2018 that gets zero traffic, and on the other hand, I have a missing H1 tag, which is a minor issue, but it's on our top converting product page. Which one actually gets prioritized? Do I really ignore the severe technical error to fix a title tag?
Yes, you do. Welcome to the ruthless reality of triage.
Wow.
Priority order is the only lever the technical SEO team actually controls. Your first sprint has to be entirely dedicated to high-impact, low-effort items. That is how you deliver immediate business value and build trust with the engineering team.
Because fixing a simple tag on a high-traffic page takes 5 minutes and impacts thousands of users.
Exactly. Untangling a server loop on a dead page might take hours of developer time for absolutely zero return on investment.
So high-impact, high-effort items like entirely reconfiguring how your server handles JavaScript rendering, those go onto the long-term product roadmap. Low-impact, low-effort items are your quick wins when a developer has a spare hour.
Mm.
And low-impact, high-effort items, you just defer them indefinitely.
And to protect that developer bandwidth even further, you should split your backlog into two distinct execution lanes.
Okay.
You have the SEO team executable tasks, things like updating meta descriptions, expanding editorial thin content, or fixing internal links inside the CMS. You do not need an engineer for those. Do them yourself.
Right.
Then you have the developer-dependent lane, reserved strictly for server-side redirects, JavaScript configuration, and core template changes.
And when you do finally assign a task to the developer lane, you have to provide clear acceptance criteria.
Always.
You don't just say, fix the soft 404s. You say, when a product database query returns empty, the server must return a 410 status code instead of a 200. You bridge the communication gap.
That is the hallmark of a mature technical marketer. You do the heavy analytical lifting so the developer can just execute. It transforms you from an operational annoyance into a strategic partner.
Incredible. So let's look back at this blueprint we've built. We started by taking the blindfold off our crawler, making sure we render JavaScript and mimic the exact user agent of the algorithm. We learned how to read the mechanisms behind the errors. Understanding why a redirect loop traps the machine while a chain just exhausts its budget.
Right.
We brought in Google Search Console to trace the journey of our URLs, deciphering whether the bouncer was rejecting us for quality or if the club was just too crowded. And finally, we brought a ruthless, business-focused prioritization matrix to our fix list.
It is a phenomenal workflow.
Okay.
When you move from guessing to diagnosing, you stop hoping for traffic and start engineering visibility.
Yeah.
But I want to leave you with a broader thought to consider as you apply these concepts.
I'd love to hear it.
As the web evolves, we are moving further and further away from simple, static HTML. We are building incredibly complex, client-side rendered applications that rely heavily on dynamic scripts. And as we do that, the gap between what a human being sees on a glowing screen and what a machine sees in the raw source code is rapidly widening.
That is a profound perspective. The human sees the finished house, but the machine just sees the raw lumber.
Exactly. And the most valuable skill in the future of digital marketing won't just be the ability to create great content. The true value will belong to those who have the ability to stand in that widening gap and act as the vital translator between the human experience and the algorithmic caller.
Wow.
If you can speak both of those languages, if you can ensure the machine fundamentally understands the value that the human is seeing, you will be indispensable to any organization.
And becoming that translator starts by getting your hands dirty and looking under the hood. Thank you for joining us on this deep dive, your immediate assignment today. Go run a 500 URL free crawl on your own digital property, double check your render modes, look at the server responses, and see what secrets are actually hiding in your code. Because until you examine the engine, you really don't know what is driving the car. We'll catch you on the next one.